if you go all the way through the book, right, if you do all the hard work of naming your sin, of seeing what went wrong, of understanding these dynamics, there is notes of hope at the end. And that we think that is the most important thing here. There is a way to be a better Christian, and it involves leaving Christian nationalism behind.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org.
In this episode of Dangerous Dogma, we're going to do something a little bit different. I do have a guest with me, but we're going to have more of a conversation as opposed to me interviewing someone, because it's a conversation about a book that I co-wrote. So, Bo Underwood, welcome back to the program. Why don't you remind people who you are, and then we'll talk about what we've been up to.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here again, having this conversation about this book that we've written, Baptizing America, How Mainline Protestants Helped to Build Christian Nationalism. Obviously, Christian nationalism is all the rage right now. And about a year and a half ago, you and I wrote a piece that's turned into a book. We'll get to some of that story. But I'm a pastor out in Indianapolis in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. I'm also a doctoral student in public affairs. And most importantly, for the purpose of this conversation, I'm still a contributing editor at Word and Way.
That's right. So people can still read your work at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And so good to have you back here on the conversation. Nice to see you at least on the video screen, although not in person like it used to be, but that's all right.
That's true. You are always welcome to move to Indianapolis.
Are you welcome to not leave me in the first place? So before we started hitting record, you said that we were going to just, you know, have this like one of our lunch conversations. And I was complaining that we didn't have our nachos at Chili's, but that's where the book was born in a lot of ways. But we'll try to make do without the chips and salsa for the conversation.
Yeah. So, you know, we have spent years talking about some of these topics, and obviously Christian nationalism is getting a lot more attention. It's something that's coming more into our sort of common vernacular as people are using the phrase and honestly often misusing the phrase. It's certainly getting some more pushback in certain corners, and some people have been adopting it as a badge of honor. You know, if they're going to be tarred with the label, they're going to sort of claim it and try to redefine it for their purposes. So let's just get started by just naming what this thing is, right? When we're talking about Christian nationalism, what are we talking about?
Yeah, this is really important to start with the definition. And this is something we try to do often when we write about it and we do in the book. And I mean, the quickest, easiest definition, we go into more detail in the book, is it's this effort to fuse and even confuse American identities and Christian identities to the point that to be a good American, one must be a good Christian. And of course, even that is defined, Christian is defined narrowly. It's not that if we have a Christian nation that then all Christians are going to get to be in charge of this country, because you and I are probably not going to be chosen for the inner circle of leading the quote Christian nation that we see with Christian nationalism. It's one slice, one narrow sliver of conservative Christianity. One of the ways that we talk about this and write about this often is thinking about Christian nationalism as it's seen in Russia. So that's a clearly Christian nationalist state. The Russian Orthodox Church is closely aligned with Putin's regime. And yet even in that regime, other Christians are among those who are persecuted. And now Christians in occupied areas of Ukraine are being persecuted by this Russian Orthodox-backed regime. And so just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're part of the, quote, Christian nation that gets to run things. And so it's this one narrow slice of Christianity that says America was intended to be started as a Christian nation and thus should be a Christian nation today and should be ruled by Christians.
I think as we're talking about this, it's important to understand why that argument is being advanced by in some corners, right? There's a decline in cultural and social and political power that's currently being experienced by a group of people, right? I mean, we're painting with broad brushes here, but it's sort of conservative, straight, white men. And they are, seeing their handle on things grow more tenuous. And so they're looking for ways to sort of regain power and to sort of put forth their particular version of a social order that they want to see govern our society. And one of the ways that they could do that is to try to make it legitimate by applying the label Christian to it, right? So all of a sudden, if to be a good American is to be a good Christian, if America was founded as a Christian nation, well, then that's what it should be, right? That founding legitimizes this vision, and this vision happens to privilege a narrow few, and it uses religion to do that. So what we really have here is an attempt to control society, or at least wield outsized influence over society by a small group of people, statistically smaller group of people, that is getting smaller by the day. But the problem, of course, is this is a threat to two things, right? It's a threat to the church, and it's a threat to democracy. It's a threat to the church because it turns the country into an idol. It makes the country beyond critique. We can no longer say, well, America's falling short of its ideals, right? Because all of a sudden, if you dare to say something's not right in America, you get told, well, love it or leave it, right? I mean, it idolizes the nation. And it also erodes our democracy because all of a sudden, not every voice is equal, right? That fundamental democratic principle that everybody gets an equal say, everybody has an equal rights is undermined by this. We have these social scientists who study this stuff, and they can show us correlations between Christian nationalism and support for Christian nationalism and things like opposition to civil rights for certain groups, opposition to interracial marriage, supporting of limitations on voting to make it harder for people to get to the ballot box. So it's scary both in terms of how it undermines the church and how it undermines the democratic experiment that really was what America was built on.
That's right. And the changing demographics, as you noted, is really important in understanding the threat to democracy side. Christian nationalism is inherently anti-democratic, at least in a pluralistic society. You could kind of have a Christian nationalism that would work through the normal democratic process in a society where most people, at least a majority, kind of adhere to the same basic Christian values and beliefs. And so I think we didn't see the anti-democratic danger of Christian nationalism for a long time in the United States. But now, as demographics are changing, there's just not the numbers for conservative Christians to run everything if it goes up for a vote. And so that's why we see this attack, this assault on democracy. We saw it on January 6, 2021. We've seen it in other places. We see it in other countries. And so David Gushee, who's a Word and Wave board member, wrote a book about defending democracy from its Christian enemies. We talked to him on Dangerous Dogma about that. And so this is an anti-democratic threat from Christian nationalism we see in a lot of countries. And I also think the other part that's really important here on the definitional side for us to highlight is the white Christian nationalism part, because that also goes with the demographic change that you noted. This idea that whiteness is a really important part in the sociological data. You mentioned that it makes those who espouse Christian nationalism are less likely to support civil rights and voting rights. They're also more likely to adopt racist ideas and support policies that would target racial minorities. And I think it makes sense in the American context that Christian nationalism is intertwined with white supremacy. Because if you're making the argument that the United States was founded as a, quote, Christian nation, it can only be a Christian nation for white Christians, because it was founded at a time when we were committing genocide against Native Americans and enslaving Blacks. And so that really can't be a Christian nation for them. It was only a nation for white male Christians. And so all of this demographic change is really putting Christian nationalism on steroids on its impact in our society today.
It's amazing how quickly that gets overlooked by David Barton and his ilk, right? That doesn't get mentioned in this myth of the American founding and what it means to be a Christian nation as they understand it. It really is your point, though, is well taken, which is, some people say, well, Christian nationalism is just a label to make conservatives look bad or it's a made up thing. It's like, no, we have data on this. Like, we have sociologists, other social scientists who study this phenomenon. They can measure it, and then they can correlate those measurements with support from polling data for other things and survey data for other things that make it clear that there's a worldview here that a lot of it is explained by this embrace of Christian nationalism. But that being said, right, like, so we're in this world where Christian nationalism seems everywhere. It seems like everybody's got a book out about Christian nationalism. You know, we have the scholarly treatments. You've got the more popular treatments. Tim Alberta's got his new book out on American evangelicals and Christian nationalism. Our book's a little different. We saw that there was something missing in the conversation. And it's funny because we spent a couple of years really talking about how is nobody saying this? And so finally, we tried to step into that gap. And what's, tell the audience, what's our niche here? What is our unique contribution to this conversation?
Yeah, the subtitle is obviously the key to understanding what we're talking about that's different than all of the other books on Christian nationalism. Many of the other books say evangelical right there in the title or the subtitle, and even if they don't, that's who they end up focusing and thinking about, particularly conservative evangelicals and Christian nationalism. But we're talking about mainline Protestants. And so obviously we should spend some time to talk about who is a mainline Protestant, what is a mainline Protestant. But this is the other half of the Protestant world, and essentially a third of the Christian world in the United States. And it's been completely left out of the conversation about Christian nationalism. And so then we said, all right, but there's Christian nationalism here too. Now, I've been in both worlds. I grew up evangelical and am now in the mainline world. And you've been in the mainline world your whole life. And our mainline minister. And so I'm going to let you define mainline with the caveat that we're not going to go into all of the different definitions and all the details that we do in the book where we spend some time unpacking. What does it mean when we say mainline Protestant?
Yeah, I tell people there's sort of two different ways to think about mainline Protestantism that makes sense to me. One is the being a member of one of the seven sisters of the mainline, the sort of seven denominations traditionally connected to mainline church as mainlines. That's the Disciples of Christ, where I'm the a pastor of, the United Church of Christ, the United Methodists, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopalians, and your favorites, the American Baptists. Now, there are obviously other denominations that are connected to mainline churches or would themselves maybe fit under the mainline definition, but those are the seven that historically have been identified as mainline. The more broad definition is what we borrow from David Hollinger, who's a historian who talks about mainliners as being ecumenically minded. Rather than putting up walls and trying to keep their people in, they're sending people out. They're wanting to work across boundaries and across beliefs. They're wanting to do partnerships. They're wanting to engage in social action. They're more open to the world. They're more open to science. They're more open to how the Bible is studied in terms of like historical critical method. They're just more open to engaging God's creation than perhaps their evangelical and fundamentalist counterparts. Now, that's a broad stroke. I mean, it's not true of everybody everywhere, but that's a way of thinking about it. You can either identify as belonging to one of these seven denominations or being the type of Christian that's more open to the world and partnership across denominational lines.
Yeah, and I think it's just important to recognize that this is a significant religious demographic in the United States. And in fact, until the late 1960s or early 70s, mainline Protestants were the dominant religious tradition in America from the colonial era on. And so which is really interesting that they get so ignored in the conversation that is so much about history. If we were founded as a Christian nation, evangelicals can't be the ones who did that because they just weren't a large demographic. Obviously, Catholics, that immigration didn't come until later. And we didn't have very many non-Christians that were involved in the United States. So if we were founded as a Christian nation, the people who would have done it would have been mainline Protestants because they're running the show for almost 200 years after the founding of the country, as well as the colonial era before that. And yet they've been left out of the conversation and thinking about Christian nationalism. And so we unpack some of that history in the book, but we also, of course, talk about Christian nationalism in the mainline denominations still today. And I think this is really interesting and important to talk about because you know that sometimes people complain that Christian nationalism is just a title that's thrown on to conservative Republicans as a critique. This is just, we're just trying to attack conservative Christians. But many of the figures that we end up critiquing in our book aren't, not only are they not evangelical, they're not conservative and they're not Republicans. So Christian nationalism can cut across a lot of different continuums.
Yeah, we've made the joke multiple times that the book really doesn't have an audience, right? It's going to make you mad if you're a Republican or a Democrat. It's going to make you mad if you're an evangelical or a mainliner, because it's going to touch on some really disappointing moments in our history where the church didn't live up to its own calling. And we didn't see that when it was happening. And in retrospect, it looks pretty awful. So, we do have hopeful notes in the book about what we think people can do, especially what mainliners can do. We can get to those later on. But yeah, it's not a great story. I mean, for example, I think about this a lot of like, if we're willing to critique today something that's going on, we need to be able to critique when that same thing happened in the past. There has to be a consistency of principle there. And you and I point out in the book, and maybe I'll let you talk about this because you really dived into it, but in 1950, right, the Constituting Convention of the National Council of Churches, the kind of umbrella organization for mainline Protestants and other ecumenically minded Christians, the gathering where they formed themselves. The theme of it was this nation under God. And you can only imagine, right, if certain political characters and religious characters held a big event in D.C. today, they rented out the convention center, thousands of people showed up, and they went on and on for days about this nation under God. What kind of outrage that would provoke from moderate to progressive Christians? We'd be having conversations about it. We'd be writing about it. We'd be denouncing it. And it would deserve those denunciations. But it happened in 1950 by mainline Christians. And we, most mainline Christians, have no clue. They don't have a memory that goes back that long that this occurred.
Yeah, that's right. And I also think one of the important things is it's not a one-off moment. I mean, it's important because it is the constituting meeting of the National Council of Churches. But then there's also a line several years later where an NCC leader refers again to the motto and says, our original and continuing motto is this nation under God. I mean, this was really what framed the organization, their goals, their interacting with the president and secretary of state and other figures are either showing up or writing letters on the theme to the gathering. Ministers are giving rhetoric about how we were founded as a Christian nation, how we should be a Christian nation. I mean, as you said, if this happened today, or if this has happened during the Trump administration, and Trump's writing a letter of congratulations, you know, to Sean, and Sean Foyt's leading music, and David Barton's speaking, and, you know, all of these figures who are rightly critiqued for their Christian nationalism today, if they had this kind of meeting, we would have written in condemnation of it. So we can't define Christian nationalism just to be Christians that we disagree with in the public square. Like that's a problematic definition. We have to be consistent here.
Yeah, that's right. And then my favorite story that we tell in the book is 2 years later, right? In 1952, the National Council of Churches has commissioned a new interpretation of the Bible, a new translation of the Bible. And so the Revised Standard Version, right, which later became the New Revised Standard Version, but the Revised Standard Version was still in the church pews when I was growing up. I'm sure in a lot of mainline churches, it's sitting on a shelf somewhere. The book comes off the press, and they take they being the National Council of Churches leaders, a delegation takes the very first one off the printing press, and they walk and hand it not to the leader of one of their churches, not to a faithful servant toiling in the vineyards, you know, in one of their congregations, but to the White House, and they hand it to Harry Truman in the Oval Office. And they have a Rose Garden ceremony where Harry Truman extols this new Bible. And he talks about how if only we could get this under the Iron Curtain, there would be peace in the world. He links the Bible to his own foreign policy aims and what's good for the nation, what's good for America. It's incredible. And again, put their shoe on the other foot today. If Donald Trump had been in the Rose Garden pushing a new God and Country Bible that had been handed to him by Paula White, we would have been screaming from the rooftops about it. And that's a hypothetical that enrages us. This actually happened. It kind of blows your mind to realize that this was going on in the 1950s.
It really does. I mean, and then there's so many other examples. Obviously, we're not going to go through all of them because we want people to buy the book. But and we just don't have time because, I mean, that was the point. We had like a few examples. We had talked about this. We had the Truman Bible example. There was a few examples where like, hey, there's something here. So let's dig into it. And then as we were going through this process, we just kept finding more and more and more examples and finding speeches. And I mean, you know, I found a reference to the Constituting Convention of the NCC and the theme, this nation of God. So I went and did looking for it, and then eventually found the transcripts of all of the speeches and letters of the meeting, and then realized it was so much worse than the theme made it sound because they were full in on this idea of creating a nation under God. And again, this is before under God is in the pledge, right? This is helping lead the work to adding that to the pledge. The National Council of Churches, mainline Protestants are why we have under God in the pledge, right? So they're literally baptizing America. They're baptizing the nation. And it seemed like everywhere we scratched for every single chapter, we're like, oh, wow. And one of us would text the other, like, look at this. I mean, it really was wild how much was there once we tried to start looking.
Yeah. So let's rewind for a minute, because I think this is a really important story for me in terms of how this book came about. So we, again, have been having this conversation for years of, you know, mainline Protestants were part of this problem. And in a minute, we should talk about why they were part of this problem, how it became so easy for them to do this, because I think that's an important piece, too. But we finally said, nobody else is saying this. Let's send up a trial balloon. So we wrote a piece for religionandpolitics.org, which is a publication of the John Danforth Center at Washington University in St. Louis that ran a year ago, January of 23. And is it like 1,200 words making this argument in broad strokes and saying, let's see who shoots it down. Let's see what kind of reaction we get from historians of mainline Protestantism, of sociologists of Christian nationalism, and even mainline faith leaders. And we sent the piece up, we circulated it around, and we got some great feedback. The Christian nationalism scholars said this is an important piece of this phenomenon. The historian said this story hasn't been told yet. The mainline leaders said this is something our tradition hasn't reckoned with. And one of them even emailed us privately to say, like, I'm going to share this with other mainline leaders. And then they got a second thought. They're like, but wait a minute, this makes us all look so bad, right? So it was a validation of the argument. And so we said, let's turn this into a book. So we started diving deeper. And yes, we had all these conversations. I remember you calling me like, you're not going to believe what I found. There's this story about how this happened. And then I was, you know, doing one of the chapters on kind of the bigger DC institutions. And I was unpacking all the different events that had happened there. And you were like, it was like whiplash. 1 month, they're doing one thing. 1 year later, they're doing another thing. And it's like, they're just serving in this kind of civil religion role that was clearly Christian nationalism by another name. But because it was the mainline church, they weren't being held accountable in the same way. And let me just say one more thing, and I'll kick it back to you, which is part of the reason they could do this in the 1950s without a lot of criticism that you would get today is I think two reasons. One, the mainliners were in the place of cultural power. They were the elites in some ways, at least within the religious sphere. And the other thing is our country was a lot more homogenous. So even though it was still bad then, it was still a compromise of the gospel then, it wasn't as obvious in the way it excluded people and in the way that it made the church into an idol, because there was this assumption that, well, everybody's a Christian and most of us are mainliners, and what's good for the church is good for the country, which, by the way, is exactly what everybody at the Reawaken America tour would say. They would say that what's good for them, what they're pushing for, they think is good for Christianity, is good for the country. It's the same impulse. We just happen to like one impulse better than we like the other impulse.
That's right. And also, as we talked about earlier, it's the demographic shift, right? As you were just noting. So, you know, when all of this stuff is happening with the National Council of Churches and Harry Truman and the Constituent Convention, all this, America is a nation of Christians, right? I mean, we may not be a Christian nation in the sense that the Constitution did not create us as a Christian nation, despite what David Barton and others might claim, but we were a nation of Christians, run by Christians. 92% of the American populace back then identified as Christian. And so, you know, if a bunch of Christians showed up and talked about American Christianity, it just felt natural because it was the lived experience of almost everyone in the country. That's not true anymore. I mean, we've had the dramatic rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E, that we've talked about with a number of authors on this program. And that has just, it has shifted dramatically to now more than a third of Americans don't claim a Christian label at all. And so now things, when you start talking about the America in Christian terms, you are civically excommunicating a much larger chunk of the populace. Not that it wasn't a problem in the 50s and 60s. It was. It was still a problem to say the couple of percent of atheists and agnostics and the 3% of people who are of a different religion, that you're not really fully American. You're not quite American enough. That was a problem, but it hits a lot different. And it's even more of a significant problem today when you're saying to a large swath of the American populace, you can't be a real American because you don't hold to our religious beliefs.
That's exactly right. And again, the main argument of our book is, all of the stuff we're saying today is growing out of the soil that a mainliner has helped to cultivate. And so we're kind of telling that story of how under God, God in the Pledge of Allegiance and how, you know, in God we trust became the national motto and all these things that a lot of these figures today are pointing to that says this is what makes us a Christian nation. It's stuff that mainline Protestants helped make happen. So in some sense, we're trying to get the mainline church to confront its own complicity in this. And then, and again, we'll get to this in later on the podcast, but then we're trying to show them what they can do about it. Some real practical ideas for how they can make a difference and not just be angry or lament it, but actually take some action. I mean, if we cause this, we should at least try to help fix it, right?
Yeah, I think it's important. It's important that we know how we got to this issue today. If we don't truly understand the causes, then we're not going to come up with the correct solutions, right? So if we view Christian nationalism as merely an aberration of the Trumpian wing of the Republican Party, which I guess is now the whole Republican Party, but only a Trumpian aberration, right? Then we're not going to truly address how it rose in the first place, because Christian nationalism was not created by Donald Trump. Christian nationalism was not created by evangelicals. And so we need to understand how we got here. And then also, yeah, it's important. If we created the mess, if you break it, you fix it, right? You have a responsibility to address some of the systemic issues that, you know, your own tradition, your own church, your own denomination helped create. And then also recognizing that while mainline Protestants today might have a less Christian nationalistic version of their faith than perhaps they had in the 50s and 60s, and it's a kinder, gentler Christian nationalism than you see on January 6, 2021, there's still Christian nationalism today in our churches, in our sanctuaries, in our hymnals. All these are all different areas that we unpack in the book. And so it's not just a historical problem. Mainline Protestants also need to reckon with Christian nationalism in the here and now.
Yep, I think you're right. This is an integrity issue for the mainline church, for all of us who value the mainline tradition. I mean, you named, if you break it, you fix it. Growing up, my dad was a contractor, a carpenter. And I remember one day I came home, it was Christmas time, there was a nice new reindeer decoration in our living room that I had seen at the hardware store. I said, why did we buy that? And my dad said, well, I bumped into it and I broke it. So I bought it and I came home and I fixed it. Now your mom has a new Christmas decoration. But for him, it was an integrity thing. He probably wouldn't have had to have bought it, but he felt like he owed it, given that he had broken their display, that he you know, owed that to the hardware store. And I admired him for it. And so again, if mainline Protestants really want to do something about this, and they really think it's the problem that we believe it is, let's start with how we got here and what we did to get us to this moment, and then what we can do about it.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
Brian, I really do want to ask you a question. We haven't talked at length about this yet. You know, we went through this whole process of writing the book, spent hours and hours, you know, collaborating. But what changed? What surprised you, and how did your mind change? You know, we go into this book, and I've got an answer for this myself. Like, we go into this book thinking, like, I know this, and I'm going to look into this more, and I have a thesis about this. But how are you thinking differently about the topic of Christian nationalism after having read this book or written this book? And hopefully read the book that you wrote.
Yeah, at least I read my parts. But so I kind of hinted at this a moment ago. This idea that it was so much worse than I anticipated is I think, an important. Now, not just that we found more examples, but just recognizing how much Christianity in America has been intertwined with Christian nationalism. It's really significant. And I think that it's the work of the church today is the work of unpacking those, of separating the wheat and the chaff, of figuring out what's gospel and what's American. Because that was what was so amazing, was just the how often and how deep the rhetoric was in essentially every corner of Christianity in America. And so, I mean, I kind of knew that, but I guess it was the degree. It was just how much it was involved, how much it was there in all of the denominations and traditions and churches and institutions, that we just haven't reckoned with this in our history and in our theology and in our hymnals. I mean, it's in the liturgy, it's in the sanctuaries. I mean, that's a really significant problem.
Yeah, you're right. And mine is similar in a way. And you're going to celebrate this, because I would argue that I've become more Baptist writing this book, right? this idea that there needs, that the separationism is healthy for both the church and the state. I think we went into this book really wanting to address the topic of civil religion. I'm wanting to talk about that and explore that, because it's been kind of, there's been a differentiation of, well, Christian nationalism is bad, but civil religion is okay. And nobody's really knowing how to draw that line. And we really put off writing that chapter almost to the very end, right? We didn't go in order of the chapter to the book. This is chapter 3, and it was like the last chapter we wrote, in part because it was such a tough topic to tackle. But I think where we both ended up, and I think you were more there than I was at the beginning, is civil religion is a gateway drug. It's going to lead almost inevitably to Christian nationalism. And it's really, frankly, a more and more confused topic as our country is becoming more and more diverse. And so that chapter, writing that chapter, really unpacked for me that, like, we're playing with fire anytime we get into the civil religion space. And I'm not saying that every expression of civil religion is out of bounds, but I am saying that I'm much more suspect of civil religion, having written this book and interrogated some of these ideas, than I was before going into the book. And I suspect you're going to sit here and say, I told you so.
That's good. I'm glad to see we're converting you. We're winning you over a little bit. But I mean, and that is important to note that there are, you know, traditions that have sometimes had, you know, this is not an pox on everything. You know, this is not, all of the traditions have been right at times, right? All of the traditions have witnesses that can help us. Sometimes, or maybe most times, they're the minority voice in American Christianity. And so we want to lift up those traditions that haven't given in to some of this stuff, that were persecuted perhaps by Christian, quote, Christian colonies, because and so they had that minority perspective that helped the theology. That's kind of the Baptist tradition that has been mostly lost today. And, or, you know, we talk about, you know, flags and in the sanctuary, and there are traditions like the Mennonite church that you don't see that embrace like you do in other mainline contexts. And so there are these witnesses that we can point to in all of these different places to say, yes, they got it. And we want to lift up those voices while we're also critiquing what has happened in other spaces.
Well, as we were putting the book together, I mean, I can't tell you how nervous I was in putting this book out in the world, right? I mean, what were people going to say?
You were more nervous than I am, because I don't care what other people think, but yeah.
I know, right? But I'm a pleaser, and you're the contrarian. But, you know, what were they, how was the response going to be like? If we were talking about where we were writing from, you know, in terms of our own social identities and locations, and who, what would provide validation in the book in a way that would really make sure we'd hit our mark. We quickly landed on reaching out to Adrian Thorne, who is the senior minister at the Riverside Church. You know, it's an American Baptist UCC congregation. It's kind of the cathedral of mainline Protestantism. And we thought, let's see if Adrian would be willing to write a foreword to the book, and what would her thoughts be. And so we sent her the manuscript. We didn't promise anything. You know, we didn't ask her to promise us anything as far as what she was going to say. You know, she could have panned the book. She could have come back and said, I can't put my name on this. And instead, I'm just going to read this quote from the foreword, a foreword that I just love. And she wrote, "The authors," that would be you and me, "the authors starkly reveal for mainline Protestants what the 1979 horror film reminded us. The call is coming from inside the house. They assemble stories and records that make evident the way mainliners created the very ideology we detest. Mixing faith identity and national identity, we produce the intoxicating cocktail now known as Christian nationalism. The authors have the receipts to prove the claim." And when I read that sentence the first time, I was just, you know, humbled and amazed and excited. And like, when she, for her to say, we've got the receipts, given the perch that she, the perch where she sits, or frankly, the pulpit where she stands, it was just incredible. It was very validating and very, really gratifying.
Yeah, it's a beautiful foreword, and it matches the tone of the book so well. I mean, we could not have had a more perfect foreword than what Reverend Thorne gave us. And you know that the church is duly aligned, and she's also a Presbyterian Church USA minister. That's the tradition that she's from and was ordained in. So she represents three of the seven sisters right there in one shot. So, you know, that's pretty good validation as well.
Yeah, it really is. Again, it's incredible, and we're so grateful to her. There were a couple other, because again, you and I are pastors, we're award-winning writers. We certainly have our own academic credentials, yours in communications, mine in public policy and whatnot. But we're not historians, we're not sociologists. And so we went out seeking a few other voices that could again, helpfully help us say we're on the right track and this is something worth reading. And then one of the things that really excited me was also what Randall Balmer said. So Balmer, who's an Episcopal priest, who's a religious historian, who's taught at some really, you know, incredible schools and written some really popular books. I mean, books that have garnered wide audiences. He said, "With deep historical research and trenchant analysis, a Jeremiad that expands the net of complicity for Christian nationalism beyond the usual suspects. And again, we didn't tell Ballmer what to say. We sent the book his way, and that's what came back. And it just shows that he gets it, right? This wanting to go beyond the usual suspects is exactly what we were hoping this book would convey. And to have him say that, like, that felt like such a home run to me.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and so having the historical side was really important. We were also really excited to see Christian nationalism scholars, you know, embrace this book. I mean, Andrew Whitehead is one of the leading scholars in Christian nationalism. His most recent book is American Idolatry. He's been on the program to talk about that, as well as his earlier book with Sam Perry, Taking America Back for God. He said anyone interested in confronting and opposing Christian nationalism must read this book. And I mean, if Andrew Whitehead had said that about another book, I would buy the book, you know, because if I trust anyone on a book to read about Christian nationalism, it would be him. And then right up there with him, Bradley Onishi, author of Preparing for War. He's been on the program to talk about that book. He's also co-host of the large podcast, Straight White American Jesus. He also said this book
large meaning popular, not popular, large meaning
much
like...
more popular than Dangerous Dogma. So, you know, well.
For now, we're getting there.
That's right. This episode's gonna take us all the way up. He said this book is required reading for anyone who wants to face the hard truth about Christian nationalism is a mainline issue that must be addressed in order to create a more perfect union for all. And so, you know, that's really exciting to have scholars in Christian nationalism say those type of things about this book.
And again, if we had sent this to Whitehead and Onishi and they had come back and been like, you know, you all missed this or you're misunderstanding something, or I really, you know, just this didn't do it for me, I'd sit here going, maybe we shouldn't publish this, right?
Yeah, so for exactly. Me,
like they're willing to put their names on this was for me this expression of like we've hit something here that hasn't been in the conversation before. Well, we're not going to read all of these, but let me just read one more that I just think is probably my favorite. It was the first one we got back. We reached out to Will Willimon, who's a retired United Methodist bishop, a longtime professor at Duke, writer of a number of books, and really one of the sort of main thinkers in mainline Protestantism, or the dominant thinkers in mainline Protestantism. And I mean, we both got this back and we called each other just kind of stunned to hear what he had to say. I mean, it's classic Willimon, but it's also sort of amazing when it comes back about your book. So I'm just going to read this whole thing. He said, quote, "A gang of white nationalist crazies stormed the U.S. Capitol, some of them carrying Christian crosses. See what you've done, all you white wing evangelical preachers? You produce these wackos who can't tell the difference between the kingdom of heaven and the USA. But now comes along Bo and Brian with a wallop of a book, well-researched, orthodox, fast-paced, and revealing. My own denomination, supposedly harmless, slightly to the left, God bless America's sentimentality, is revealed to be a precursor of a mess like January 6th. This book has caused this mainliner to take a sober theological assessment of my church and its unknowing complicity in the nascence of ugly Christian nationalism. Thanks to Baptizing America, I have met the synchristic, idolatrous, confused nationalist. It turns out that he looks like the nice, middle-of-the-road, moderate Methodist me. Oops." I mean, to me, that is incredible writing, and it just, like, I'm chuckling. I'm like, I want to go read my own book after hearing Willimon say that. It's just really amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's great. So, it's been really exciting, affirming, humbling to see the responses that we've been receiving already. So we feel pretty confident telling people they should read the book, because you don't have to trust us and our opinion on it.
Yeah. And again, we're not sitting here because we're expecting to, you know, get rich off of this book. That's not the way publishing works in our area. I mean, we're not doing
Don't worry, everyone. We won't quit our day job. So we'll still be here next week on Dangerous Dogma.
Yeah, we're not doing this for that reason. We're doing this because we think this is an important part of the story that hasn't been told and needs to be told if we're going to have the fullness of Christian nationalism in terms of our understanding and how to address it. But what's so gratifying here is these leaders who themselves are in this conversation, who care about the church, are saying this book needs to be read because this book has told that part of the story. Like, that's something I'm going to always be thankful for, no matter whether we sell 5 copies or 500,000 copies of this thing.
obviously, we hope we're selling more than 5 copies because we think this is a story people need to know. And we think it's a helpful step in congregations, in denominations, in individual Christians, than working to undo Christian nationalism in their own context, in our society. So as we wrap up our conversation, let's kind of talk about that, like our hopes for the book. You know, we don't just want people to be smarter, although I really do think you'll learn a lot from the book. We also hope this leads to some clear actions in the future.
Yeah, and I'll confess to being really frustrated here. You know, we are all aware of the sort of us versus them dichotomies that govern our society right now, the sort of tribalism that seems so entrenched. And we really like to blame them, right? So when it comes to Christian nationalism, we really like to point fingers and say, you know, look at what they're doing. Look how awful it is. I mean, honestly, it makes us feel good. It's very cathartic to scream and yell at somebody on social media or to rant about somebody in a sermon. Look how bad they are. And what we're kind of calling for here is to get our own house in order as mainliners, to look at how bad we have been and we even are still today. Part of this is me realizing that what I write and say is probably not going to change the minds of somebody like Greg Locke and his and the church that he's connected to. He just doesn't care what a mainline Protestant preacher in Indianapolis says or writes. But there are groups of people where I have influence. There's people where I can sway and get them to take a second look at things. And so what we need to be doing is exercising our voices and our impact in those places where we can actually make a difference.
Yeah, and I think that's what we hope people take from the book is that you really can make a difference in pushing back against Christian nationalism because it's right there in your own church, in your own tradition. We may look at something like the insurrection at the Capitol and think, well, I can't make a difference. I can't win over those people. I can't stop that from happening, hopefully not again here in several months, but I don't really have an impact on that. But what can we do in our own traditions, in our own ways to separate some of the Americanism, not that we're not anti-American, but we're saying that's not gospel. Right? And so making sure that we recognize this is what Jesus taught. This is the global faith that we've been called to and that we profess to follow. And so how can we live into that more fully, more richly, in more meaningful ways? And this is something that every single one of us can actually do. We can all work to do that hard work on ourselves of unwinding the Americanism, unwinding the Christian nationalism from our theology. And so there is something practical we can all do.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to give all the secrets away right now because we do want you to go out and buy the book. And frankly, there's too much to unpack in the short amount of time that we have. But lots of ministers have fought fights and even gotten fired over the flag in the sanctuary and how to deal with that dynamic, right? We're going to offer a way in this book to address that and hopefully that makes your congregation more faithful and more robust rather than ending up in conflict. As we've talked about, there's a whole history of mainline Protestantism of not understanding how our traditions have been complicit in Christian nationalism. We're going to give you a way to interrogate your own story. And we are going to talk about the need for social action and social witness so that we can continue to be a voice that calls out Christian nationalism for the heresy that it is. But what it all ultimately comes down to from where I sit is there's too much going on right now in American Christianity or American culture where to be Christian is associated with this form of Christian nationalism. And we need the mainline church, and frankly, every church, to create a contrasting witness, to show people there's more than one way to be Christian in our society. And we think that that's actually really appealing because we think that Jesus is pretty compelling. And so if we can just get our churches to stop participating in this phenomenon and to reject this ideology, we think it's going to make our churches more faithful. We think it's going to lead to growth. We think it's going to help people be more like Jesus. And we think that's really good for the church and good for our country.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier the rise of the nuns and how much society has changed. Younger generations, our generation is walking away from churches as they are today. What if churches would offer a different version? I mean, we haven't unpacked this much, but we do talk about Christian nationalism almost as a competing religion. And so like, how do we move from Christian nationalism to Christianity? Right? How do we give people the compelling good news of Jesus? And that might help reach some of the people who are looking at the church and saying, nah, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Right? Because they don't want the Christian nationalism.
No, I think this is real. And it's, I mean, Christian nationalism is so damaging to the integrity of the church. And there are a lot of people saying, if that's what it means to be Christian, I want nothing to do with it. And the problem is they're not finding an alternative. And it's time for the mainline church to be true to its own convictions on this stuff and really offer that alternative that we think, again, makes our democracy better and makes our church better. And I'm excited. Like, I really am. I mean, if you go all the way through the book, right, if you do all the hard work of naming your sin, of seeing what went wrong, of understanding these dynamics, there is notes of hope at the end. And that we think that is the most important thing here. There is a way to be a better Christian, and it involves leaving Christian nationalism behind.
And so, I mean, that's why we wanted to have this conversation. I think the book, the way you just framed it right there, lines up so perfectly with the vision of Dangerous Dogma. Of all of our conversations with various authors that we cite in the book and others, is how do we strip away some of this dangerous theology and ideologies that's been wrapped up with Christianity? And also recognize that following Jesus and what Jesus taught us is dangerous in its own unique ways. And so we think our book adds to that very vision of Dangerous Dogma, of as Christian nationalism is truly a dangerous dogma that we need to confront and find out what does it mean to follow Jesus instead of Christian nationalism.
So shameless self-promotion. The book is available for pre-order. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever you normally buy your books. But our publisher would prefer, and we would prefer, that you buy it at chalicepress.com. And the good news is that if you go there, you can use the discount code BAPODCAST for Baptizing America Podcast, and that'll get you a third off the cover price. So not only can you buy it straight from the source, but you should be able to buy it at the cheapest price at chalicepress.com.
And I'll put links to all of that in the show notes at dogma.wardenway.org. Well, Bo, thanks so much for joining us on the program. And I enjoyed our conversation. And I still miss the chips and the salsa. But other than that, it was fun to be back with you.
It's fun to be together. I wouldn't have wanted to do this with anybody else. It's been a joy. And I hope that our audience finds as much reward in reading the book as we've had in writing the book.
And don't forget to check out our website, wardenway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wardenway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wardenway.org. Thanks for listening.